My name is Andrew Porter, and my new novel is The Imagined Life.
Andrew Porter has found himself pulled to the unreliability of his characters and narrators throughout his previous books, and the same is true for his newest novel, The Imagined Life. It follows Stephen, a 50-year-old man trying to uncover the truth behind what happened to his father, who disappeared when Stephen was just 12 years old. Set in 1980s California, the book transports readers to a different time when Fleetwood Mac owned the airwaves and issues like homosexuality and mental health were simply not discussed. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Andrew Porter. Can you give our listeners a description of The Imagined Life? I mean, there's a part late in the book where the protagonist is quite specific about, quote unquote, the imagined life. But I'm thinking on broader terms, you know, maybe just an overview of the book.
Sure. So it's set in California, and it's about a man named Stephen Mills, who at age 50 finds himself separated from his wife and son, and sort of uses this opportunity to go back and try to figure out what happened to his father, who was this brilliant professor and who disappeared in 1984 when Stephen was 12. And so part of the novel takes place in the past in 1984, and part of it takes place in the present as he tries to figure out the answer to that question. And so it goes back and forth between the two timelines.
As you said, Stephen is on a journey to unravel the mystery of who his father truly was and what happened to him. But at different points in the book, he wavers back and forth between how much he actually wants to know. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, even in the beginning of the book and on the first page, you know, he talks about how sometimes we don't always want to know the truth about our parents. And I think a part of him is afraid of some of the answers he might uncover. And so even as he talks to some of his father's old friends and colleagues, he's hesitant about learning, you know, certain information about his father. And I think it just comes from a natural ambivalence to sometimes not want to know everything about your parents.
So throughout this journey, Stephen would meet with his father's former colleagues and friends, and sometimes their stories would contradict each other a little bit. Could you talk about the reliability of memory?
Sure. That's been a major theme in all of my books and a big interest of mine. I love to play around with the unreliability of memory. And this novel, because of its premise, gave me a great opportunity to do that. And so I wanted, as the novel progresses and as Stephen learns more information about his father, in some ways, the picture of his father becomes clearer. It also is becoming more complex because some of the information he learns is contradictory. And so I wanted those two things to be happening, for his father to both becoming sort of clearer figure in his mind, but also a kind of more elusive one.
The story is told through first person perspective, which we come to learn is a diary of sorts. Stephen is revisiting memories through writing. We talked about the reliability or unreliability of memory regarding Stephen's father's friends. Is that reliability or unreliability the same for Stephen's memory?
Definitely. I think he, you know, he becomes a kind of increasingly unreliable narrator himself. And that's another thing that I always enjoy playing around with in fiction. And it's something I enjoy about first-person narratives in general, is always questioning the reliability of the narrator and of, you know, the story itself. And so that was something I was definitely, that I wanted to kind of call into question more and more as the novel progresses.
Talk to me about Proust. Why does Stephen's father love his writing so much? And are you similarly enthralled by Proust?
Yeah, you know, one of my big fears is that people would ask me a lot about Proust when this book came out, because the father character is kind of obsessed with him. You know, he's a scholar, he's a professor, and this is one of his great passions. I have read Proust and am a fan, but I think, you know, my reasons for having the father interested in Proust is because I wanted to kind of draw a connection in some ways between Proust as a writer and the father as a character, because, you know, from what I know of Proust's life, you know, he he published late. I think he published Swan's Way when he was maybe in his early 40s, and his first book, and he self-published it, because no one would publish it. And so there's this sense with Proust that he was not appreciated by his peers initially, right? And the father is a similar type of character who, in some ways, feels like his genius is not fully appreciated by his peers. And there's also other similarities. Proust had a very close relationship with his brother, and there are other parallels with Proust's life that I wanted to kind of hint at, but it was more about Proust the figure than it was about his work, if that makes sense.
There was also, I think this was Stephen, though, talked about having a Baldwin period and an Alice Munro period. Were those autobiographical at all for you?
Yeah, I mean, but they were a little bit. I think that the authors that I mentioned there, and actually in some cases, I know Baldwin, and I think I mentioned Annie Ernaux, those were two writers who I was kind of reading at the time that I was writing this novel and thinking about a lot for different reasons.
You know, when I look throughout my questions, I see that I keep saying Stephen's father, Stephen's mother. Did we ever learn their names, or am I just forgetting? Is it because we're reading journals?
We learn the mother's name in, I think, one or two instances. Her name is Maya. I think
Oh,
maybe in
yeah.
only one instance where the father writes a letter to her and it's addressed to Maya. But the father, we never learn his name. And that was a deliberate decision on my part because I wanted there to be this mystery surrounding his character. And so I thought that if I didn't name him, right, that that would kind of add to that sense of him being this sort of mysterious figure. So I made a conscious decision at a certain point in writing the novel that I didn't want to actually name him.
Staying on the subject of names, Stephen talked about his father's friends, and he would use like their first and last names, and this was specifically noticeable with Derek Evanson. Can you talk to me about why, whenever he mentioned him, it was always Derek Evanson?
Right. So I don't think this is too much of a spoiler because it's established early on in the novel that the father has a relationship, sort of secretive relationship with one of his colleagues, this guy, Derek Evanson. And I think because that relationship is upsetting to Stephen at that age, particularly because it's outside of his parents' marriage and he sees it as a threat to his parents' marriage, that he distances himself in some ways from this character by referring to him by his first and last name, right? He's not going to use his first name because that would suggest a closeness or an intimacy with him. He wants to keep this person at a distance. And so I think that was behind, using his first and last name. Yeah.
You mentioned the setting earlier. It's California, 1980s. The setting is vital to the story. There are no cell phones, no social media, notably, but it's also vital concerning attitudes toward homosexuality and the pop culture references, specifically like Fleetwood Mac and Stevie Nicks. Does this time and place have special meaning to you?
Yeah, I mean, the character of Stephen is roughly my age. And so a lot of those cultural references are things that I remember at that time when I was about Stephen's age, growing up in kind of the late 70s, early 80s as a young person. And so, yeah, for example, Fleetwood Mac, that was, I remember my brother playing Rumours like constantly, my older brother, when I was like 5 or 6 years old. It was kind of like the soundtrack to one summer of my life. And so, the music that I allude to, that helped me as a writer to kind of place myself in that time period as I was trying to imagine it. So as I dropped those references in some ways they were helping me to remember that time. And so, yeah, those were very intentional.
I was visiting with a couple of recently tenured professors last week, and they asked me who I was interviewing next. And at that time, I was perhaps a quarter of the way through your book. And so I was trying to explain how this had to do with Stephen's father not getting tenure. And they said, "Oh my gosh, this book sounds like a horror story." But, you know, thinking about the faculty and staff politics within the English department where Stephen's father works, in your experience, was that, you know, was that more or less universal?
I mean, I think there is, particularly at that time, I like to think academia has kind of changed. But I think at that time, that kind of viciousness that the father alludes to, I think that was fairly common, And, I think that, at the time of this novel, like the rules for tenure and the kind of the protocol and the regulations, I wanted that to be kind of less formalized so that, subjectivity could play a part and that people could just, deny someone for personal reasons. That's much harder to do now for legal reasons. And so at that time, though, I wanted it to be a situation where we don't know whether Stephen's father is being denied for legitimate reasons or whether it's personal or whether it's related to his relationship with Derek. And I wanted there to be a lot of different possible explanations for why it happens. And I think setting it in the 80s, when I think things were a little bit different, a little bit looser, allowed for that ambiguity.
What do you make of current attacks on tenure?
I mean, I think tenure is really important. The idea of kind of getting rid of tenure, I think, is a deep threat to academia, right? I mean, when you get tenure, it gives you a freedom as a professor to kind of research what you want, write about what you want. It allows for academic freedom, right? And so when you take away tenure, from professors, they're much less likely to do the type of work that they really truly want to do. That's my personal feeling.
Now, I have not asked about mental illness because, I mean, although it was like foreshadowed in the book early on, Stephen would talk about his father's marginalia and trying to figure out if he could decipher from that. Explicit mention doesn't come up until later in the book. And I don't want to spoil it for our listeners, but I don't want to not acknowledge it as, if there's something you want to talk about with mental illness.
Yeah, I mean, I think that much less was understood about mental illness at the time that this novel takes place. I think there were stigmas attached to it, even stigmas, attached to going to therapy, being medicated, these types of things. And, I think one of the tragedies of the novel is that Stephen realizes that his father's life would have probably been a lot easier had he had help, right? But because of the time in which it's set, he didn't seek out the type of help he might have sought out today.
Well, the book is The Imagined Life. Andrew Porter, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's really a delight to do this, and I will continue to be an avid listener, and I'm excited for this to appear and for people to hear about it. I really, really appreciate it.
That was Andrew Porter, author of the book The Imagined Life, which was published by Knopf. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.